From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today, an update of the news from Latin America and the Caribbean with our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo, in Managua, Nicaragua.
As usual, there's so much going on, it's difficult to know where to start. But I think that the most important thing that's happened over the last couple of weeks since we last spoke was the meeting between Cuba and CARICOM, the Caribbean Economic Community, which took place about a week ago, and they produced a declaration about a week ago, and although that might not seem a big deal, certainly in global economic terms, it does seem to me a big deal in regional geopolitical terms, because it seems to me that it's. And I've been looking at the way U.S. policy has developed in the region over the last 15 years, something like that, longer. But if you look at the way things have been going over the last 15 years, there's kind of incremental changes, kind of interspersed with quite dramatic events, like, for example, the coup attempts in Venezuela and Haiti, some of which were successful and some of which were not, Ecuador, Bolivia. And so you see these incremental changes in the region that signal the end of United States' unquestioned dominance in the region. And I think this meeting over the last weekend, I think it was, between Cuba and CARICOM is another one of those incremental changes.
Yeah, the declaration was issued on the 11th, okay? And it invokes, one of the things it does is invoke the 2014 declaration of the region as a zone of peace.
Right.
Another thing it does is move forward economic relations between Cuba and the community.
Yeah, and so, and I think that's a sign that, and even the small island nations of the Caribbean are saying in a very gentle way that they reject United States policy in the region. It shows how isolated the United States government is in terms of, in particular, its policy on Cuba, but also in general in terms of its policy in the region, because that meeting between Cuba and CARICOM is kind of in the context of the overall medium-term drive towards regional integration that has, over the last couple of years, has suffered some setbacks, but it's by no means derailed.
Not at all.
And I think that this Cuba CARICOM meeting demonstrates that even relatively small and vulnerable island nations in the Caribbean realize that there's been a permanent, long-term change in the region, which demands of them an effort to promote and deepen regional integration, and that's what this joint declaration that they made as a result of their meeting with Cuba means.
Yeah, some of it wasn't so soft, by the way. Under item 21 of the declaration, it says, we reiterate our firm rejection of the application of laws and measures contrary to international law, such as the Helms-Burton Act.
Right. And that's not just relevant for Cuba. It's relevant for Venezuela, too. And we can move on to Venezuela perhaps in a moment. But there's something else that I wanted to add to my comments about the significance meeting between Cuba and CARICOM, and that is that if you look at that, and then that explains a great deal about why the United States is so determined to maintain its stranglehold on Haiti. Because if you look at the rest of the region, then in the past the United States could depend on very pliant governments in places like the Dominican Republic, for example, or places like Jamaica or Trinidad and Tobago, those places. Now, the government in the Dominican Republic is now, in the recent elections, they re-elected Leonardo Fernandez, who's a kind of left of center social democrat politician, but someone very much in tune with the general progressive trends that have been promoted by, in particular, Fidel Castro and Hugo Chavez before their deaths, and that are currently being promoted and developed and deepened by Nicolas Maduro, Evo Morales, whoever's likely to succeed Rafael Correa in Ecuador, Daniel Ortega in Nicaragua, and as well as leaders of movements that are currently not in power, like, for example, Lula da Silva and Cristina in Brazil and Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner in Argentina. And so, you know, if you look at that, what the profile in the Caribbean is one that is... The United States has very little foothold there. I've always been puzzled about why is the United States so desperate to keep its boots on the neck of Haiti. And I think that's one of the that's the main reason why, because they've to put it in from the perspective perhaps of the US State Department, they may interpret developments in the Caribbean as them having lost the Caribbean.
Yeah.
No, which is unprecedented in terms of the history of US foreign policy over the last 100 years.
Yeah.
And that explains why they're so desperate to keep Haiti in the desperate condition that it continues to remain in and has been in ever since. What? Ever since the end of the Duvalier regime, really?
Well, really, for 215 years, it's been a tradition since the Haitian Revolution. I mean, that shook the foundations of the United States that had, at the time, a largely slave economy. When the enslaved threw off and slew their slaveholders, that had folks in places like South Carolina and Virginia scared to death.
Yeah, and the ironic thing about it is that even under kind of right-wing gangster regimes like that of Michel Martelly and his current successor, you know, that have come to power as the result of hopelessly flawed electoral processes run by Western governments and the Western NGO community, even under those governments' foreign policy still acknowledge the beneficial influence of Venezuela and Venezuelan-Cuban initiatives like Petro Caribe. They've been incredibly helpful to Haiti, given all the tremendous difficulties and challenges that Haiti has faced over the last, however many years you want to put it, but especially over the last 10 to 15 years.
I'd say 215.
Right. So, you know, the only reason I mention that is because those meetings, like the Cuba-CARICOM meeting and the declarations that result from those meetings, never get reported. But they're actually tremendously important.
Absolutely.
If you're looking at the nitty-gritty of how the region is developing and what that means in terms of not just US government policy, Canadian government policy, North American policy, but also policy of the European Union to the region.
Yep.
So then, and you can see a response from the United States and Canada to that reality in the latest play by Luis Almagro, the Secretary General of the Organization of American States, who has now produced a document that tries to insist that Venezuela holds elections this year.
This is a second try, right? This is the second try for that, isn't it? They were trying to meddle before, too.
Yeah, they tried to do it last year, and now they're having another go. And this time they're backed up by that vote in the U.S. Senate that said that there was a vote in the U.S. Senate, 2 weeks ago, along the lines that the Democratic Charter, of the Organization of American States, should be applied in Venezuela. And now you've got the kind of administrative quasi-legal development of that from the Secretary General of the Organization of American States, who's insisting that Venezuela should hold elections this year. Why are they doing that? Because they know that time's running out, and as the government in Venezuela successfully implements the its programs and policies developed in response to the vicious aggression of the Venezuelan right wing over the last couple of years, in particular since December 2015, when they won control of Venezuela's Legislative Assembly. And it's interesting, actually, that there was a very good article by, I think it's a Canadian academic, I'm not sure of his nationality, a guy called Arnold Auguste. And he wrote an article about the Venezuelan opposition you never hear about. And what he was referring to was the fact that the opposition in Venezuela's National Assembly at the moment is, in fact, are composed of the legislators elected for the Venezuela's United Socialist Party, which is the party of government, but they are, in fact, in the national legislature in Venezuela, the opposition. And I think Auguste is quite right to point out that you never hear about that, the fact that in the national legislature, the opposition is trying to defend the gains of the Bolivarian Revolution made since Hugo Chavez came to power back in 1998.
Yep.
Against a right-wing dominated National Assembly that has proved to be completely ineffectual in terms of advancing the right-wing agenda and the US agenda in Venezuela. So that and so in that context, what you now have is Luis Almagro, Secretary General of the OEA, trying to follow up the vote in the U.S. Senate, arguing for the application of the Democratic Charter of the Organization of American States against Venezuela. And I can't remember in over the last 3 or 4 years, I can't remember a more extreme example of the way the Organization of American States is completely dominated by the agenda of the U.S. State Department.
Well, you know, Trump promised, I mean, this would have to be executed by the White House, the Pentagon, and the CIA, and all of that, and also, you know, taken to the OAS by the State Department, which, again, is under the executive branch. So Trump has campaigned on no more regime change. That's supposedly his stated policy that he's fighting with the deep state about. And this is going to end up, I assume, at the OAS at a vote where the U.S. and Canada may be on one side and everybody else on the other. So it's going to be an interesting tell for what to expect from the administration in Washington, too.
Yeah, and I think that's absolutely right, Don. And I think the U.S. is heading for another humiliating defeat in the OAS. Because the last time Almagro tried it, and I can't remember the countries that voted in support of his initiative, but he lost by a large majority, and it's so strange that U.S. diplomacy is so inept. Well, maybe it's not strange, but
well, it's also chaotic right now. There are a lot of Obama people in senior positions at the State Department still, at the CIA, certainly they're still in control of that, in my opinion. In and around almost every agency, the Justice Department, a whole bunch of them. And that's what the strategy that the Democrats have been playing, and some Republicans, I would say the deep state has been playing, in terms of the congressional approval of sub-cabinet members like Deputy Attorney General and such, is because they're conducting a war against the White House And they're trying to, like, when they stripped him of Flynn, they stripped Trump of someone who had deep ties and loyalties in the defense intelligence community, you know, in the NSA and other places. And when they had the attorney general recuse himself from anything involving Russia, the person that's poised right now to conduct that is someone that was put there by Obama. You know, in other words, so a lot of things that we're seeing manifest, including some moves, in my opinion, that we've seen deploying troops to Syria and other things. If they're done with the White House's assent, that's the maximum, action taken by the White House, that these are really being motivated by people who were holdovers from the prior regime.
Yeah. And so, yeah, and I think the U.S. is heading for another fall and diplomatically in the Organization of American States if they try and push that.
Right. The vote's going to go like one of those U.N. resolutions against, against the U.S. over Cuba. It's going to be like the U.S. Israel doesn't have a vote, neither does Palau or, Marshall Islands, as they do in the U.N. But so here it'll be the U.S. and maybe Canada. And that's it. And I don't know if Trudeau could actually vote for that.
Who knows? But however that pans out, it seems to me extremely unlikely that the U.S. and Canada, if Canada votes with the U.S., are going to come out well of it. And I think you're absolutely right to say that that is another of the acid tests that are going to demonstrate the general trend in the region. In terms of whether the emancipatory policies of the last 15 years or so, almost 20 years now since Chavez won that election in 1998 and came to power as the president in Venezuela, it's 20 years that we had these progressive policies promoting regional integration that the United States has completely failed to prevent in any substantive way. I mean, they have occasional successes, like the soft coup against Dilma Rousseff in Brazil, and the spurious electoral victory by Macri in Argentina based on completely false campaign promises. But otherwise, the United States has proved itself incapable of preventing the change in the region that has been signified by the dramatic social and economic advances on behalf of the impoverished majority in countries led by progressive governments. And of course, the other acid test that's going to happen within the next couple of weeks on April the 2nd, which we talked about in our last conversation, is the second round of the presidential election in Ecuador.
Yeah.
Where the Lenin Moreno, the candidate for the Alianza País party of current President Rafael Correa, now seems to have a very strong advantage of over 10% in comparison with the right-wing candidate, a guy called Guillermo Lasso, who came second in the first round of the voting. And that very much bears out what you and I were saying in our last conversation, that there's a whole series of reasons that make it extremely unlikely that the right wing in Ecuador will be able to defeat Lenin Moreno, who's very much regarded as the successor candidate to Rafael Correa. And Rafael Correa, over the last 10 years, I think he came to office, if not power, back in 2006. And Rafael Correa has done tremendously well in defending the impoverished majority in Ecuador against both the attacks from the right-wing political and legal and economic establishment in Ecuador, and also defending the majority of people in Ecuador against the ups and downs, the volatile ups and downs in the international oil market.
Yeah.
So then, I think that's going to show in a quite categorical way that all this talk about that we heard over the last 12 months or so about a conservative restoration is kind of whistling in the dark. I mean, the people who promote that kind of analysis of the region have nothing solid on which to base it, and in terms of, you know, how do the majority of people in Latin America feel about the political, social, and economic progress that's been made over the last 15 years? And there may be kind of temporary setbacks, but overall, and it's very clear that feeling in Latin America is very much in tune with the continuation of those policies and the continuation of that social and economic and political change in the region. And I don't think there's any doubt about that. And if you look at somewhere like Colombia, for example, and that phenomenon of support for the idea of moving forward and change and developing socioeconomically and setting aside political differences that are essentially and in practice counterproductive. And you can see that, and I think that is one of the readings that one has to make of the Colombian peace process. It's not just about the internal history of Colombia and the end to that desperately tragic and horrible period of civil war that lasted for over 50 years. And that thing, from Colombia's internal point of view, internal development, that's tremendously important. And there was a major step forward in that process over the last few days when the Colombian legislature voted for a law creating a juridical, a legal, an administrative context to facilitate the peace process. So what does that mean? That means that the forces of extreme right wingers, essentially fascists, are deeply linked to drugs dealing paramilitaries like Alvaro Uribe, are unable to stymie, sabotage, and otherwise hold back the peace process that's been set in train by Colombia to the great credit of Juan Manuel Santos. And paradoxically, I was reading something earlier today. Apparently, Juan Manuel Santos has felt obliged to apologize for contributions to his election campaign from the notorious Brazilian engineering multinational giant Odebrecht company that has been caught up in scandal after scandal in one country after another for its involvement in bribing leading domestic politicians in different countries in the region. And it's likely that the Colombian peace process, ironically, will be what saves Juan Manuel Santos from being caught up in becoming a victim to this scandal, the Odebrecht. It's called, most people call it the Odebrecht scandal, that is affecting so many countries here in the region, in particular in South America.
Yeah, you know what's interesting, too? One of the things that Uribe's failed, I mean, they more or less blew their wad on that referendum, and now they're not able to influence the legislation and other things that are material with respect to the peace process. They can't stymie it. That shows that there's considerable buy-in among the elites there.
Yeah, yeah. And I think it's very likely that in the next presidential election, Santos's vice president will do very well. He might not win the election, but he's likely to do very well. And he, I think, over the last few days, he resigned as vice president in order to be able to run in the presidential campaign in Colombia.
And when is
but
that?
He's paradoxically, although he's somebody who tended to situate himself against the peace process for a long time, paradoxically, he's likely to be a beneficiary of that peace process because he'll be regarded as one of the political leaders of the party that brought about peace in Colombia, which is, I don't think, and it's very difficult for people outside to Colombia to appreciate how supremely important the end of the war is there.
Yeah, it's you know, when you've had a war going on for 60 years, it, when it ends, it could be felt in a lot of parts of the country.
Oh yeah, absolutely, and Colombia, in many senses, has been held back in social and economic terms, precisely by that civil war. So now it's over. It's good for everybody. It's good for the capitalists, and it's good for the impoverished majority too. And so then what's likely to develop in Colombia will be a more normal political process, allowing the political arguments about, and should a country be run by a tiny corporate capitalist elite, or should it be run for the benefit of the impoverished majority? And that political discussion will now be able to take place in a normal political context, insofar as any political context is ever normal. So then, looking on that theme, it's worth having another look at Brazil, isn't it? Because you can see that Brazil and Argentina. Because you can see that in Brazil, there's growing popular protest against the continuing moves by President Temer, the usurper president who ousted Dilma Rousseff. And what his latest stunt is to try and cut back pension rights. You know, I find it impossible to understand what is the political program of the Temer usurper government in Brazil, because they're doing everything in a way that's going to make it as unlikely as possible that they or their political associates are likely to get elected.
I know.
When the next elections come around, it's extraordinary unless they're thinking of carrying out some kind of permanent coup.
Yeah, it's like if you know, they have a political death wish or something. It's amazing, really.
Yeah, and the same in Argentina. Mauricio Macri, his policies, and he cynically promised the people of Argentina zero poverty during his election campaign back in October 2015. Uh-huh. Now poverty is much worse.
Yeah.
Unemployment is much worse.
Yes.
And the social and economic crisis in Argentina shows no sign of abating or relenting in any way.
Yep.
So, you know, and when all those people that were talking about the conservative restoration, and I think they need to look very hard about what's actually happening on the ground and what is the response of most people in countries like Brazil and Argentina. And it's not, very obviously, it's not a positive response. And you can see that again in Venezuela, where the support for the government is much, much stronger than it was even a year ago. You know, because people they look at the rest of the region, they see what's happening in Brazil and Argentina, and they see how the right-wing opposition has created a crisis and constantly attempts to deepen the crisis in Venezuela. And their response is to reject right-wing ideas and right-wing politics.
Yep, that's what happens. Once they get to see it up close and personal, especially on the personal part, they lose enthusiasm for it if there ever was any held.
Yeah, and if you look at the regional context, and what are the right-wing elites trying to do now? Well, they've lost the Trans-Pacific Partnership in terms of the participation of the United States, and that's a very significant change from U.S. regional policy under President Obama. And fair play to Donald Trump for making that change. So now what they're doing is they're looking at how to salvage what they can from the TPP, and they're creating a kind of new legal status for other countries that might not be able to satisfy the quite stringent demands for the Pacific Alliance countries. The Pacific Alliance is a right-wing trade bloc consisting of Chile, Peru, Colombia, and Mexico, plus some smaller associate countries. And those countries, the Pacific Alliance is trying to cement closer to the right-wing corporate capitalist trade agenda in Latin America by adapting in this new structure that gives privileged status to states that sign up to that right-wing agenda. I think they're closing the door after the horse has bolted.
Tony, thanks a lot. It's been a pleasure.
Okay, you're very welcome, Don. Look forward to talking to you again.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.